Which describes how you're feeling all the time. Which describes how you're feeling all the time. There's this guy in the sky, and he makes you want to make you sigh. Like the time when you felt like you're feeling all the time, and you sighed at the cracks in the ceiling all the time. You said, I'm feeling fine, but it didn't really rhyme. It didn't rhyme overseas. Which describes how you're feeling all the time. Which describes how you're feeling all the time. When you lie that your life's unappealing all the time. But your lie doesn't rhyme with the word overseas, overseas. There's this guy who describes how you're feeling all the time. In his mind he can find how you're feeling all the time. From behind distant lines even straighter than his spine. Which is fine, which is fine. And describes how you're feeling all the time.
There's that idea that the shadow is what we're like. So when I was in Shasta at this abbey and I was hanging out with these monks, they were talking about how the Buddha doesn't go into the light, that everybody goes into the light. And we say this thing like, oh, go into the light. And it's like the light is rebirth. It's like the birth canal, right? I mean, they didn't say that, but it's that principle that they're saying you turn around to the darkness because there is no darkness. And that's the whole point. Is that we're afraid of what's behind us, thinking that, you know, and it's like why, like, you know, God covers the eyes of Moses so that all he can see is his back parts as he passes by him. So he never see, all he can see is the shadow. But that was his revelation.
But you see, that's very Saturnine, right? Because Moses is a Saturnine creature, right?
Sure.
I mean, I'm not dissing in any way, and I hope you know this, to me, like Hebrew mysticism, for an English-speaking person, if you want to know the secrets of the universe, that's where you look. That's it. I'm saying, I'm even saying, like, that's where you look. You go looking there in that place where they have the thing with that thing there.
Yeah.
It's in, I mean, it's, and it's there. All the answers are there. And yet, I believe that there is a hidden, this hidden challenge that is always implied. And, you know, Kubrick speaks, ... What is the relevance of Kubrick talking? I think there's only one relevant piece of sound material from Kubrick that he ever made, and that is his speech at the D.W. Griffiths Award. Everything else is bullshit, as far as I'm concerned. He lays it all out. He talks about money and power. That is what he talks about. D.W. Griffith made a lot of money, but we need a better machine. That's what he says. We need a better machine. We need to build better wings. And he's referring to this in terms of Icarus, who couldn't make it all the way to the sun because the technical prowess used to design the wings that carried him could not handle the heat of the sun, right?
Right.
Well, so that's your ritual of the hexagram right there. It's actually stated that it's designed to place you as if you were at the position of the sun. So my thesis right now, and this has been sucked out of me by you guys tonight, so thank you both for that, because I can't believe I'm saying this, because it's just coming out of nowhere right now. But my thesis right now is that the ritual of the hexagram actually conceals the possibility that there is an actual baptism of some kind of higher order when Saturn is removed and when the idea of any sort of order of the self from... It's a top-down process, I guess that's what I'm saying, right? You know, being baptized in the sky as opposed to in the water might be... Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
Well, it's interesting, too, the relation between Saturn and Uranus mythologically, right? Like,
No, it's not Ionis, it's Uranus.
It's the same character. Saturn is the son of Uranus, right?
Saturn is a son of Uranus. Well, yes, a son, but... a very powerful and overtaking sun in the mythology, right? So I don't think it's actually fair to Saturn.
He castrates Uranus.
Yes, so it would seem, and this is what I'm talking about here. Maybe this is, to me, this is, I think, what Kubrick might be hinting at, is that if a certain type of, shall we say, order of strength, based upon a feminine, or what we'll call an alternating or dual principle, is to remain permanently intact, then Saturn must be positioned continually over Uranus. In other words, time as a principle must bind us more than the fact that our mind may actually expand in principles beyond time, right? When we think about dreaming and stuff like that, like this conversation is timed. That's just a fact. It is actually scalable in time. And that is an inescapable fact. But what if the mind as Uranus, essentially, the sky, is not scalable in time? And this is what Kubrick is trying to continue to say, look, we need to find better ways to stop potentially the kinds of discussions that you and I and, you know, that we are all having here tonight. I don't know. Or to stop people from feeling like they are necessarily scaled within these kind of God versus human, these above and below, these heaven and hell, these dark and light principles. And, you know, this kind of goes into the whole idea of monadism, dualism, pluralism. I'm not even sure that any three of those, quite frankly, any of those three are sufficient.
Yeah, I don't know either. Yeah.
Non-ism, right? Like, why ism? The ism zero. Itself implies a directional emphasis.
Zeroism or zero.
Which is the name of Gilliam's latest film, right? The Zero Theorem.
Really?
Yeah, I haven't watched it yet.
See, I'm wondering about Saturn as well. Like mythologically, Saturn, like he's associated with time now, right? But Saturn is also in the underworld, right? Like he was placed in the underworld by Jupiter, by Zeus, right?
Yes.
So our idea of Saturn is the fallen Saturn, right? Whereas before, Saturn was associated with the golden age, right? It was a time.
Well, see, this is the whole. It's incredible. Like, so in the traditional system of Kabbalah, as I was like focusing on, is that Jupiter is Yesod and Malkut is Saturn. But if you look at the fact that there's relating to Malkut that she is in exile as the Shekinah, and that the whole goal of the work of the rabbis traditionally, which is the opposite of what is going on nowadays in terms of general occultism from all the various schools, is that they wanted to reconcile the tree. Now you have this enforcing of the tree, or strengthening the tree as it exists and clinging to that. Whereas like the intention of rabbis traditionally is to take Malkut and lift her up to Ze'er as the Tiferet. So Tiferet and Malkut get reunited, and that's the thing that allows the supernal triad to lower into the seven lower spherot, thus forming the star.
Yes, yes, yes. And well, see, this is the thing. This fits in with Kubrick's model, right? So am I being laughed at? Because I'm pretty hammered right now. So,
sorry.
So I mean, when I say hammered, I mean I've smoked like probably a quarter since I started talking to you guys, and I put half a bottle of gin as well. So.
Oh, that was gin. I was wondering about that. I thought the way you drank it, I thought it was water. Back when when we had video a while back, I was like, oh, and you slug it so like it was nothing. I was like, oh, it's probably just water.
No, it's gin, pure, uncut. Gin.
Nice.
As a matter of fact, I can drink gin all day and I never feel thirsty.
All right.
Actually, you know what? I'm having a great time talking to you guys, so I want to tell you this little story, but if you guys need to cut out or if I get to be too verbal. When I was a kid, I was in the seventh grade, there was this books sale they had, everybody was encouraged to bring in their junk and to raise money for some kind of school project. Mm. And they had this sale, and what I was interested in that time was books and reading. I spent my entire youth reading, basically. It was just a way of tuning out reality. And I bought this book called The Polluters. And it was vicious pornography. I was like, I don't know, maybe 11 years old, 12. So the reason I'm reminding you is because this character who's in the book, the only reason he doesn't get this sex disease that attacks everyone is because he drinks only pure liquor. Right? And this is, of course, right out of A Clockwork Orange. Or not A Clockwork Orange, but...
Dr. Strangelove. Yeah, okay.
I drink only rainwater and pure corn.
Right. Which is very relatable, too. Because once you know that a Dr. Strangelove is, admittedly, by Kubrick, that the subtext is all about intercourse between the U.S. and Russia. And that the climax of the film with the bomb is actually... So if you were to relate it to the tree and recognizing that Shekinah is literally the tip of the genitals, right? And that literally, like, what is taking place here with the fucking conspiracy for our bodily fluids with the communists.
Oh, I know. With fluoride and everything else. Exactly.
Yeah, you dig it?
Yeah. And this interesting. Could go to what Kubrick's talking about in the D.W. Griffith thing, where he's saying, you know, we need to build better wings to find a way to keep this thing in place. So I guess, you know, I guess I've made my big point for the evening.
Okay.
Yeah, I just went over the edge, guys. It takes a lot. It takes a lot. But I've been talking for some time now. So, all right. So anyway, Znor, what about, you know, like the whole, what's going on in your world?
What's going on? It's damn hot here.
Oh, yeah. It's hot here, and I'm sure it's hot in Seattle as well.
It was, yeah. It's just there.
Yeah, I know that they, well, okay, you live in the Pacific Northwest, though, right?
Oh, me? Who, me? No, I live in California.
You're kind of in Santa Cruz, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What part, do you mind if I ask, David, where you hail from and what you're kind of, like, where you grew up?
I grew up in Santa Cruz. So I was born here. I was raised here. It's just a little south of San Francisco.
Well, I mean, you just bleed California, right? As a human being. It's sure, obvious sure. to me that you are a Californian.
And oh, I
just
yeah. I am like, that.
It's very, you know, you're like, you're, like, this is...
David,
you know,
just, David, were you in, sorry, were you in Santa Cruz, when was that? About 93 or something, there's a huge, 94 maybe, there's a huge Food Not Bombs protest. Like, they had passed all these city ordinances in Santa Cruz banning people from serving food on the streets and sleeping, like, homeless. And,
yeah.
Do you remember that? Or,
yes, absolutely, yeah.
I got arrested there. I was arrested in Santa Cruz, yeah.
Were you sleeping in a sleeping bag in front of
the... No, they tried... The cops... I showed up for this Food Not Bombs feeding on the street, and the cops showed up and tried to kick everybody off the sidewalk. And so we just decided to sit down. It was just this spontaneous sit-down protest, and we got dragged off. And they took us to, we got escorted in the back of a police car, and they took us to this parking lot of the police station and made us sign this promise to appear notice. But I never showed up for it. But that's kind of my big memory of Santa Cruz.
Have you been back to California since then?
I have, yeah. I didn't get stopped or anything, so I'm not sure if that's still on the record. I doubt it is, right? But
yeah, I wonder about that kind of thing too. I've been fingerprinted once in my life, for instance, and I wonder, does that file still exist?
Yeah. Huh. Santa Cruz is awesome, though. It's a great little town.
Yeah, I love it, but it is getting worse and worse in that regard of what you're describing.
Well, everywhere is, right? So
yeah, and it's kind of ritualistic. So like on May 1st a few years back, there was a protest, a peaceful protest, and these people just came out of nowhere wearing black masks, black outfits, and smashed a bunch of windows, blew up cars, did a bunch of stuff. The police are literally a block away, literally, and it took them over an hour to show up at all. And then when they did show up, they only arrested one homeless man who jumped in, and none of the people who were part of that ended up getting arrested. It was crazy. And so the fact that it was Beltane, the fact that right afterwards, within a week, there was multiple specialists that came in to deal with that kind of like situation with a $1 million salary each. And it seemed to be the justification for that. And it was really overt. Like, I doubt that was like a new idea, you know. So it was very suspicious. A lot of suspicious goings on here. The 89 earthquake was a big shift in that way. They used that event as a way to institute all kinds of ordinances, and they've only increased them ever since. But it was and that's talk about synchronicity. That was my first synchronicity. My earliest synchronicity was when I was a kid and I was at a Van shoe store in Watsonville. And I was looking up at this cutout board of the San Francisco Giants versus the Oakland A's for the Battle of the Bay, they called it. It was the World Series, right? And did I say Super Bowl before? Anyways, World Series. And
what year was that?
This is 1989.
That wasn't the year of the earthquake, was it?
It was.
That's the Oakland A's versus...
So the day of the earthquake, they're playing the game in the middle of the game. And the Bay Bridge, the top section of the Bay Bridge that connects Oakland to San Francisco, broke in the middle and fell into itself. And I was a kid, and I remember seeing that on the news afterwards and watching it take place. And I was like, how can that just, like, I was like, does anyone else see this? Battle of the Bay, the Oakland, San Francisco? And I knew very little about it. I was like, is this real?
That's the exact right feeling.
Yeah, it was something to add to that. I was, when, in 89, I was watching, I went to the theater and watched Dead Poets Society, right? Which I just watched again last night, just because of the Robin Williams.
Interesting, okay, yeah.
And I was sort of blown away by that movie when I first watched it. And I came home, yeah. And that's when I first heard about the San Francisco earthquake. It was on the exact same, that just blew my head, the connection of those two things. So it's weird that you're talking about that, and I just watched it again last night.
Oh, wow, yeah. In
years. Right?
Yeah, far out.
You know, I went to see the movie Out of Africa on the same day that the Space Shuttle Columbia exploded.
Oh, man. I can't wait until I get out of Africa.
I was like, oh, yeah, what do I do today? The Space Shuttle just exploded. I think I'll go to a movie.
You guys know about that thing you can do with the titles of the different missions, and if you form it into a sentence, if you do it in order. Have you ever seen that before?
Yeah, yeah. It's Freeman, I think it is. Yeah.
No, fill me in. I'm living in ignorance here.
The Discovery to something Atlantis challenge.
All challengers will be destroyed is the way that it's taken. You know, the implication.
No surprise there.
Yeah, it's weird. It seems kind of symbolic. Yeah, especially when you're looking at Jack Parsons' involvement and all of that stuff. It's just it's really weird.
Well, this is a fascinating web that we're living in, right? I mean, and the way in which things connect to each other begs pretty much every single philosophical and metaphysical question there is.
Definitely, so let's come back to that. Like you, Mark, you were talking about some idea of like Cthulhu or sort of like the old ones returning, a kind of idea.
Well, in terms of messaging, I'm convinced now that this actually must be taking place.
Right.
Particularly since I did some research in regards to the Madeleine McCann case. My publication career began in relation to the Madeleine McCann case. My old blog no longer exists. I deleted it after I suffered from like post-millennial internet freak out. And there's the first third or more of all the articles I ever wrote, I deleted one day. Because I was some guy, a friend of mine, I've never met this guy, he was the first guy who started being interested in my blog, started talking about rape and stuff like that in the comments and how he was going to tie a woman to a tree and rape her. And I'm like, that's it. I've had enough of this internet thing. I am out of here. So I took everything down. But it started with this interest in Madeleine McCann. Well, recently, very recently, I came kind of full circle, I was looking at the Madeleine McCann case again, and I was talking to David about this a little bit earlier. There is simply no question now. There's no question that there is an existing network of pedophile / satanic / ritual murder things going on. All right. Mm-hmm. And to me, there's no question. This is now undeniable. Like, the only way, there's always a switch here. There's always a sting in the tail. But the fact of the matter is, the only way. And you mentioned this again. You actually asked this question earlier in our conversation, Snor. If it isn't that it is so, then it's clearly that we're being told that it's so, or that there's a persistent message that it is so. This can't be separated. It can't be. It's not. It cannot be. And I will go right down to the fucking mat. Like, I'm a chivalrist, philosophically. And that means that if you ultimately disagree with me and if you really want to settle the question, let's just fight to the death. No, seriously, why not? Yeah. Let's do it.
All right.
Let's get this fucking question over with. Because I'll, whatever. Maybe I'm wrong. But what could be better than sweet, sweet bliss and endless Nile feeling nothing? So, you know, that's the whole thing. If I'm right, I'm willing to go to the wall. And I know that I'm correct about this. There's unquestionably, and I actually talked about this with you, David, because it was actually you fucking phoning me up in the morning or leaving me a message asking me if I wanted to be a last-minute guest on Always Record.
Right.
And it was because of that bullshit that I ended up watching this show early in the morning. And, of course, early in the morning I can actually get picked, right? So I'm sitting there, you know, huffing, puffing in a great cloud of blue smoke, and I see this episode of Law & Order, which I talked about in detail on Always Record 86. And the way it's put together, they're clearly saying, look, we do this thing where we kidnap young girls and then sexually abuse them and assassinate them. And there's even further an underlay of it where they're saying, logically, you know, it's just a 1-2-3 kind of conclusion. Let me put this in terms of Kubrick again, okay? And I don't want to go into offensive territory here, because I really like you guys, and we all love Kubrick. We're all fucking amazed by how great a genius this man is. I don't take that away from, I mean, maybe Stalin was the same kind of genius. I don't know. But that's quite possible. And I never hold genius against somebody, because it's got to be expressed, right? So I'm not talking about judgment here. But let's take the question that is stated in the movie The Shining, all right? So what Stuart Ullman says at the exact moment that the character of Scatman Crothers, you know, Halloran appears is, we can't, you know, we don't keep any booze here during the winter because it fucks with our insurance. Now, he's making a term on the phrase jigaboos, right? It's a racist reference. Mm-hmm. It's saying that we can't trust people to, black people to run this place because they're fucking constantly hitting the Colt 45 and they're hitting up their bitches and then pretty soon it's blood and guts everywhere. So our insurance riders make sure that we have white people that run this place during the winter. That's what's being said, and it's being said encoded. Now, there may be some doubt about this because it's an NLP code. However, I challenge anybody to watch the recent episode of Downton Abbey. And in that, for the first time into British society, a young black man, black African-American male character is introduced. He's not just an African. He's already lived and grown up in the United States, the son of slave children. And he's become a jazz sensation. So he ends up being the first black person ever invited to the Downton Abbey, which, by the way, I have identified in my very brief meanderings as the planet Jupiter, right? So he's been the only black person to be invented. Now, downstairs, while they're playing the music, the red-headed cook named Mrs. Patmore says, well, I don't know what to make of this music, but it certainly does make me want to jig about. Okay? There is no question that there is a racist sentiment that is in, like, now here's the question I'm asking you guys, okay? Because have you guys both seen the movie Raising Arizona?
Yeah, sure.
Ages ago, yeah.
Do either of you have a copy of it?
No.
Well, I recommend you get one, because there's a scene. Now, I have an incomprehensible article. It's my longest article. It's called The Redheaded Cinema Society. I do not recommend you read it. But I touch upon this in this article some many years ago, in which I tried to, that article was an attempt to analyze The Big Lebowski, which is one of the most occult films ever made. But anyway, in terms of the density of the detail, right? In my research for this, I was watching and looking very closely at the Coen Brothers films and Raising Arizona. All right, now there's an image in this movie, and this is unmistakable, and it is a fact. It can't be taken away. And any child with the moderate ability to do, I'm talking about sixth grade geometry, would be able to see this as clear as day. It's the scene where he goes in to get the Huggies, and he's runs in, and she and the baby are in the car, and he runs into a convenience store to buy some Huggies, right?
Sure.
Now, outside at that time, she is reading to the baby, who is like literally a newborn child. She is reading to this baby the story of Red Riding Hood, or not Red Riding Hood, but the Three Little Pigs. And the piece of the literature that she's quoting out loud and that she says is, I will huff and I will puff and I will blow your house down. All right. Now, if you the next time you guys look at this movie, take a look at this scene very, very closely. All right? And you will see this. A cut inside, taken from inside the store of Nicolas Cage and the clerk. Behind the clerk, sitting on the desk behind him, there are certain items. And these items, and there's that banner that reads either cigarettes or smokes. And there are some zigzag papers on there, and there are some rolly-type tobaccos that you can see, all right? And then it cuts to her outside, and she says, and I will huff and puff and blow the house down. Then it cuts back inside to the same perspective. But now it's a reflection, and you're seeing the reflection of where Nicolas Cage, what Nicolas Cage would see in the reflection if he looked in the mirror, right? Or if you look in the window out into the dark night. And what you will see is that in the place where clearly the word cigarettes is written, now the word candy is written.
Oh, I gotcha.
Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, the question that we ask, and I'm asking this about many keys in Kubrick as well, to put a B in your guys' bonnet, is what the fuck are these people doing to my fucking brain?
Right.
Like,
right.
What?
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, you look at how many pyramids show up in cigarette packs. Why is the standard cigarette pack the golden rectangle, and the part at which you open it is the point at which you draw the first line to square it? And all the advertisements have just two cigarettes sticking up out when it's open, so that you know the other point to square the rectangle. The thing with like Gimel and Camel. So you have Camel cigarettes with the fucking pyramid on the back, and that like. Right. Like Gimel, from its Phoenician origin, meant killing stick. You know, it's like it's and what's up with like all the fucking quotes? Like on Paul Mall's, you have the Constantine quote about "By this sign, I'll conquer," and then you have on Marlboro, it says, "We came, we saw, we conquered." You know, this whole conquering the public
the
thing.
Character Constantine is dying from lung cancer.
Is that right?
Yeah, he's a smoker. He's in all the comic books. He smokes constantly. He always has a cigarette in his mouth or his hand.
Interesting. There you go. Yeah.
And of course, Constantine was the emperor at the time, the Roman emperor at the time of the crucifixion of Christ. No, that's not right.
No.
Constantine was the one who codified Christianity into the Roman panoply.
Yeah,
that's another story. But I was wrong. It's Tiberius that was there at Christ then. But anyway, yeah, that's interesting. Amazing. But however, David, what you're talking about, all of that stuff. As completely legitimate as it is, it's all in advertising, right?
Right.
And we can say, well, sure, here's why they do it. Because they're trying to add a cachet. They're trying to add a gleam to a product. And therefore, the logic is natural, right? But when you see it hidden, deftly, carefully, sneakily, into a piece of entertainment in which one in probably 10 or 20,000 people who ever watched the film.
Yeah, you just got your ass NLP'd.
You have to ask yourself the question, is this commentary at a very, very subtle level, which is to say, are these individuals trying to draw something to our attention that they cannot do directly?
Right.
The only other thing it can be is B, it's programming.
Dude, so I'm watching the film Sideways. You know the film Sideways with Peter Giamatti or whatever?
Yeah, Paul Giamatti.
Paul Giamatti, excuse me.
I've seen the film. Yeah, I enjoyed
okay,
it.
Do you know what happens at 4200 on that film?
No idea.
So if you go to that film, and anyone can try this, I was like, did I just see what I think I saw? I fucking almost gasped. So basically, they're drunk. And they're going between shots, and they're fading in and out of the, and they're having a conversation. And one of the guys holds a bottle of wine, and he says, "Hey, what does this remind you of?" And it's a bottle that says White Craft 2001.
And White Craft.
White Craft 2001. And then immediately afterwards, on 42 minutes 00, a finger goes up in between shots, just barely fucking visible. And it bends. And if you turn the volume way up, you can hear the character go, "Red rum." And he says, "Red rum" on the fucking 42 mark with, okay, "Hey, what does this remind you of?"
That could be kind of that could almost be seen as a joke, right?
Sure. But like, then at the same time, it's all inside joke, you know, but like at the same time, it's rubbed in our faces.
Well, yes. I mean, the thing of it is, with there's some sudden, like, the reason that I'm making a distinction, that is incredible. And it actually relates to what I'm talking about because, first of all, tobacco is red rum, right? As a matter of fact, when I go out, when I say goodbye to you guys in about 20 minutes, because I run to the store and get some more tobacco.
Me too. Before
it closes. and before my mom gets home and starts asking me if we can watch Big Brother After Dark immediately. And by the way, just to let you know how fucking weird this world is, there is a player in the current Big Brother lineup, and her name is Jocasta, and she constantly wears a bow tie around her neck. And I'm thinking to myself, holy mother of fuck, are we now living in a world where, the internet actually exists, where someone would name their child Jocasta, and then that child would go on to constantly be wearing something that was a stricture around their neck? Because Jocasta hangs herself, right?
Right.
She's the mother of Oedipus, right?
Yeah. And this character, who is named Jocasta, constantly wears a tight bow tie around her neck, even when she's not wearing, like, a shirt, right? Huh. So she's constantly got this fucking strangulation. I'm like, what the fuck is going on, man? It's just insane, you know? That's how I feel. That's where I'm at, gentlemen.
This is a weird thing. I don't know if this has been noticed, but you know the newspaper in Clockwork Orange, right?
Yeah.
This storm over crime cure boy, right? Mm-hmm. And if you look
Storm over what?
Storm over crime cure boy, right?
Oh, crime cure boy. Okay, yeah.
Doctors blame government scientists for changing Alex's nature, right?
Right.
But if you look at the date of that,
yes,
it's like, I don't know if you've looked at this frame. I've got it. It's actually in my article on the Funeral Parade of Roses, right?
I'll read it. Yeah.
And it looks like September 11th, 1972.
Ah, very interesting. 72 would be how many?
Yeah, September is definite. 1972 is definite, and you see the one, and a little bit of a smudge in the second digit, but it looks like an 11, right?
So very it's September 11. I want to read that article big time now.
Well, that's the deal. I'm fucking tripping the fuck out over that shit with Supertramp. I don't know if you got a chance to see that before I took it down. I know Mark did. But like,
dude,
because that's the joke. You're looking at a monolith floating in space on Crime of the Century, okay? And then it's got hands in bars. So you're in bars in the monolith. It's called Crime of the Century, you know, Century of the Self, whatever. But then Supertramp Breakfast in America, if you do the mirror image of it backwards, you have the 9 and the 11 coming out, extending out of the two towers. I don't know if you've seen what I'm talking about.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. So like there is a fucking sync phenomenon with those albums and that film, and it's
911.
The weird thing is that this newspaper is also called the Mirror, right? But
right.
Half of it is in the frame, half of it is cut off. So you only see the mirror image of the mirror, right? You only see the bottom half of the
letter. Oh my god, then, dude, that's so applicable.
No, but the guy who wrote the article, it's by Lewis Carras.
Lewis Carras?
Does that sound like?
Okay.
Lewis Carras, yeah.
So I was just thinking that a minute ago.
Alice in Wonderland, right?
Right, because when you read 1984 and he's like, they're like 2 + 2 = 5, the Alice in Wonderland, the only admitted subtext of Alice in Wonderland is that it's a joke on the fact that he saw the dawn of algebra and he was a mathematician. And so he was like, what the fuck? You guys are going to go off into fucking Wonderland and you're not going to know nothing would be what it is because everything would be what it isn't. And like, that's the premise and that's the control.
So you're saying that there's a recognition that there's a revolution in the way we think about numbers that is taking place in 1984.
Well, yeah, but that you could see it either way. You could see it as a system, not a system, but a means of control. Right, where it's like basically because you don't know what's what and where is where, so you try and go down the fucking 9/11 rabbit hole, and you can't tell where conspiracy ends and where just the fucking underpinnings of the labyrinth of the Matrix begins. Like, and you can't do anything with it anymore because it's just everything all at once. And like that scene, it's like the difference between Aldous Huxley and George Orwell is like George Orwell was always like, there's not going to be enough information. People are going to have a suppression of information, and that's going to be the means of control. And then Aldous Huxley's like, we're going to have so much fucking overload of information, we're not going to know what to do with it. But we can't take a position anymore because everything cancels itself out or something because there's so many sides. But then when you look at what the implications are of 2 + 2 = 5, it's like, that's the same fucking thing.
Well, see, now this goes to...
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
See, I just think that this ends up biting them in the butt as well, right? Like, whoever they are, right?
Well, because this is...
Because the foundations of everything get thrown out eventually, right?
Well, but
they don't even know what 2 + 2 = anymore.
Exactly! That's what I get when I watch Century of the Self, man, and I'm just like, oh yeah, Edward Bernays is fucking, like, playing the public. He's pretty, like, as if he wasn't victim to the exact same influences that he's manipulating. And that's the fucking irony. That in and of itself is its own type of valid solution.
Sure,
so I think that's our strategy, right? Like, that's our strategy. Just, like, people say order up chaos, right? But let's keep the chaos going so no order is able to form, you know?
That's kind of a cynical, and what by cynical I mean, like, maybe technically accurate. But I tend to think of the concept of chaos in terms of, like, say, insurance, right? Like, people buy insurance so that they don't get into accidents. That's what they actually think they're doing. Even though what they're really doing is that if they get into an accident, they're covering any financial responsibility that they might have. Insurance is not possible. It's an impossibility. You cannot, therefore it is a kind of an immoral, it's almost like Las Vegas. It's a gambling system.
Right, yeah.
You know, it's like the whole idea, well, wait a second, you know, what exactly is insurance going to do for me? Well, absolutely nothing. It will not stop the accident that kills you from happening. Right? And yet we live in this world. We're living, in my view, in an Alice in Wonderland world, and it's as simple as cart before horse. But it's literally no more complicated than that, but it is so pervasively seductive in terms of its promise that to show somebody, look, all you have to do is simply flip these two principles around, right? For instance, what good have the police ever done anyone, any victim of a crime? Well, none. The police have never done any victim of a crime any good, ever. Because by the time they're a victim, that's when the police show up.
Yeah,
right? You know, and this is what I think is we're looking at time backwards. To me, this is the way the human condition fails, is that we're completely looking at time backwards. And we also look for solutions in this sense elsewhere, right? As opposed to in an immediate sort of sensibility. Like, is there a reason to be upset? Well, is there, you know, any riot taking place outside of your house? For instance, would you guys say that it's possible that by the continual media bombardment that we're getting about terrible riots going on in different places, that the tension beside the water cooler begins to grow?
That seems to be the purpose. Right?
Yeah, well, maybe, but never. Maybe they're just reporting what's happening, right?
Possibly, yeah.
Well, I mean, because, you know, like my mom was saying to me, you know, did you hear that every major U.S. city now has a small tank with their police department, and the over 600 of these cities have now, in the last several months, acquired these tanks? And she's going, doesn't that say that there's going to be a conspiracy theory and they're going to roll those tanks into the street so that they can prevent, so they can set up their new world order? And I'm saying to her, well, yes, that's a logical possibility. But it's also logical that there was a very, very good salesman somewhere who just had a sales pitch and there were 600 old tanks sitting around, because that's what they all are. They're all surplus tanks, right? And they decided to sell these fucking things. You know,
it could also be that the system is falling apart so much that they're scared as well. They don't know what to do. They're buying more and more tanks, more and more security, more and more weapons, more and more police.
But they're not. They appear to be the ones who are selling the tanks and the security and the weapons and the police.
Well, they would profit off of it as well, right? But I don't know. It's a weird split, right? Like there's sort of the profit motive and fear at the same time.
Right.
Stuck in a catch-22.
Yeah.
Or a toroid shape.
Yeah, where you're always, catch 44.
You're always going over the horizon, right?
Yeah.
We look toward a horizon, which is what we see as the event horizon, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the human beings are trained to do this, and I think this training may be actually a kind of an evil. And this is like, if there's anything in our conversation tonight that I've repeatedly, that I feel that I'm trying to stress, is that I'm questioning this idea at least. I certainly wouldn't say for certain. Because one of the things I wonder is, what if we lived in a, you know, I always find it easiest and most potent, at least for me, to put this in terms of like an actual experience that you have, where you first have a thought, you go, oh, hey, you know, and then there's always a reason for me. There's always something happening that makes you think about something in a new way to me. And I remember, you know, as a movie lover as a kid, right? Like movies were something that I used to escape. I just wanted to sit and look at a film on TV late at night after I avoided everybody all day, and I would, you know, be able to see that, or I would go to a movie theater, and it would be pure escapism. And I think, you know, David would understand this because you're from California, where people really actually just watch movies a lot, you know, because it's like the Nile, it's the River Delta of cinema, you know, Hollywood, right? And Southern California, and California in general, people there have a much closer connection to the world of cinema than, say, somebody where I live in the middle of nowhere, where there's not even a repertory cinema, and if I want to actually see a film on the big screen, I maybe at the university if I'm lucky or something like that, right? So I would watch films and I would see these things and I would, you know, just, I would feel excited by them and what they, the different things, but then something would happen, right? And all of a sudden I'd go, oh, wait a second, this is interesting. Philosophy would just jump to the fore. And this is happening to me over and over and over. And when I saw the first Raiders of the Lost Ark movie, when I came out of the theater, and I was 14 when that, maybe 15 when that film came out, I know I was too young to go see it, and I had to sneak in because 16 was the limit to go to see that film in my area. Mm-hmm. And so I went and watched the movie, and of course I loved it, right? I mean, it's a fucking fun film to watch, and it's also a worthwhile film to analyze. There's a lot of funny things in there, like, for instance, you know that stick that he's got, and then he has to break off 6 inches to get the alignment right, because he got the reading wrong the first time. Yeah, that's circumcision.
Right, okay.
He's circumcising the stick. And the actual stick itself is a vagina, or it's actually not a vagina, it's a vulva. The image that is implanted on that Nazi guy's hand is that of a vulva. And at the top of it, there's a clitoral jewel. And if you listen to the dialogue of the film Raiders of the Lost Ark, you'll actually hear him say in clear language, you know, this is a woman's pussy that I'm holding here, and I'm putting it on a dick. So I should probably break off this a little bit, right? So there's all that stuff in there. It's like, you know, in that sense, it's a great movie. But I'm watching the film, and as I came out of the movie, I thought to myself, hey, wait a second. You know, I've really enjoyed this film where this swashbuckling defender of what is right has swooped across the world and, you know, killed several people, randomly sometimes it seems, right? You know, and all for the possession of this object, the ark, which then goes into, oh, wait a second. Oh, yeah, you know, there have to be bad guys for this to happen. The reason that I can enjoy an experience, the whole concept of the heroic self is predicated on a kind of resistance. And that resistance is like bad guys in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. And maybe there's something inherently false to that entire dialectic, right? Maybe there are no bad guys, and the bad guys themselves are just the concept of bad guys that are invented as a kind of a barrier, like a spot on the sun, right?
That's the Holy Mountain, right?
I guess so. Yeah.
Gravity. Gravity is the ultimate bad guy, right? So
right.
Gravity is a bit. Yeah.
Totally. That's why
you don't
no
need
drama
to get to the top of the mountain.
Yeah, there's no drama without conflict, and so right. You have to.
Yeah, I mean, what's up with that, man? Like, so what would our lives be then? So I guess this is what I'm saying to you guys. I mean, I'm just kind of pouring this out here. Is that this is the limit that I can reach. Is that I'm presented with the possibility that everything that seems to give me a sense of a positive tension, right? And tension would be inevitably the ability to move from point A to point B and feel like it was a positive thing, right? Every single thing in life that provides that for me seems to be tainted by this kind of inertia. There have to be bad guys. There have to be things to get away. There has to be ground to build on and ultimately people to step on if you want to climb this ladder of being something meaningful in this teleological, A to B, linear, time-based world, and more importantly, scalable time. Because I have ideas about time that, you know, like time as a non-scalable thing. But this idea that, and rulership, and order, and law, and all these things go into this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that, like, where can you go from here?
Mm.
What do you guys have for me?
Well,
be free.
I don't know, back to Icarus, right? Like, so his father Daedalus tells him two things, right? Like, don't fly too high, or the wax will melt and you'll fall to the sea. But don't go too low either, or you'll crash into the sea.
Of course.
So it's the same
about walking thing. And that becomes the razor's edge in Buddhism.
Right, the middle way, right? Like that's.
Well,
that makes a lot of sense to me.
There's your serious thing. Like, that's the thing. Like, so you were mentioning that Dion Fortune equates Da'at with Sirius. But if you look at...
I don't know if she does, but one of her disciples
said that. Oh, I
see. Right?
Okay.
So I'm not sure if she... That'd be interesting to find out if it directly came from
her. That's in Morals and Dogma. That's in Albert Pike's whole deal. And that's why you see the sun and the moon as Joachim and Boaz, but then the central pillar... is represented by Sirius, according to the Freemasons.
He doesn't really say it's that. It's a central pillar, but I haven't seen that equation until recently, right? Go on. But,
dude, it's everything. So when you're looking at the moon card in tarot, you were mentioning Kuf, you know, the back of the head. What do you see? But two towers, right? With a dog and a wolf, so a domesticated animal and an undomesticated animal, right? But specifically that they're dogs, so you have Sirius. But and then if you look at even in Crowley's deck, he has Anubis, the guide to the underworld, which is, for the Egyptians, that's the canine constellation, where Sirius is, you know, the eye of. And so it's, you could say, oh, yeah, it's God, backwards, dog, whatever. I don't know. That's English, because this goes way before English ever showed up. You know, but no, it's just, it's really weird too. Cause if you look at the ritual for the dog, Sirius, who was the only dog to, it was, or not, what was it? It was a fire dog that died in the 9/11 event, and its name was Sirius, and they performed this huge ceremony for this dog, Sirius. Yeah. Pretty ridiculous.
In the canine force, right?
Unbelievable.
Oh, and then the canine thing, because you're like, okay, yeah, Shin is
canine 9/11, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Shin is the canine tooth. But then if you add K, which is 11, to 9, you get 21, which is the judgment card in tarot, who means Shin. I mean, that's the letter associated with judgment is Shin. So you add canine together and then you get that.
Well, 21, just for the purposes of interest, as it relates to the whole ritual of the hexagram that I was talking about before, because the sum total of the digits 1 through 6 equals 21, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's representing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. As standalone digits, they add up to 21.
If of you course, add up to 36 doing the same thing, that's how you get 666.
Yeah, well, that happens when you add all the digits from 1 to 36. Yeah, that's right. You get 6. Yeah, of course. Yeah, but...
Which, just really quickly, that's the amount of days. So when Stanley Kubrick died, it was 666 days before January 1st, 2001.
Oh.
Yeah, I heard that.
I can't, like, this is just too much. And yet, not really. I mean, I love this stuff, of course. But I'm looking for that thing, that Tumblr to click that goes, oh, okay, now I see the world in a different way. And in terms of the numbers 1 through 6 adding up to 21, well, 1 through 6 are the numbers on a standard die, of course. And this gives us a cube, right? Because a die, a regular die or a dice,
mm-hmm.
a single die has 6 sides.
Right?
Right? And by the way, as a matter of interest, each of the sides always add up to, what do they add up to? 7, I think. But that's beside the point. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do add. They add up to 7. So when you compare the two opposite sides, they're always like 6 will be against 1, 5 against 2, and so on, giving you this sensation of 7, and then the cube representing both 6 but also 4, and Isis. And again, to me, this a hexagram is, of course, a flat version It's like the way that you would, when you draw, the simplest way to draw a cube in two dimensions to indicate a cube architecturally is to do so as a hexagram, right? And that way you have one corner and you have the four corners extending out mm-hmm. from, mm-hmm. Yeah, and that, so this is the way in which you can visualize, very easily visualize in two dimensions a cube again. And this cubical concept now, which I have related, which I relate to Vallis by way of the idea of the movement of information along surfaces, all right? And the revolution of Philip K. Dick was, I think, that he sees that there's this tape loop, right? And, mm-hmm. you know, he visualizes that there's a period of time. And he, if you look at his... I didn't have to look deeply. Again, I've read very little of his exegesis, maybe less than 20 pages. But I read the side notes because this is back when they were out on this before the book was published, back when they were being compiled. And they were free on the internet at the PKD site back in like 2001, 2002. And one of the things that he wrote in the margins was this. He said, the Jewish alchemists found a way to loop time back around itself to forestall the coming of the head Apollo or the return of Christ, who would establish a paradise on earth, right? As promised mm-hmm. after the crucifixion, okay? So the idea is this then. Now, and I'm not, I mean, when I say Jewish alchemy, like, obviously, you know, I have this thing which I call the hangman's loophole too, which, and this is something that Dick, that didn't occur to Dick, basically, was that if indeed these so-called evil Jewish alchemists did create a time loop in which everything would cycle back to an original point and go over and over and over again to forestall the coming of Christ, then they would subsequently be making man immortal.
Mm, yeah. Right?
That's what they would actually... This is not in Dick. And if it is, I'd like somebody to point it out to me. This is my idea. And this is what I call the hangman's loophole, right? It's this idea that if indeed an eternal loop has been created, then this would be fundamentally the same work that Christ would do by returning and making the earth a place in which all human beings lived eternally within his body, right?
It's immortality in hell, though, right?
Well, yes, but it's going to be the same either way. How could it be any different, right?
Well, I don't know. There might be two different things, right? There's endless time, and then there's eternity, right?
Yes.
You're talking about endless time.
Yes. Well, I am fond of time.
Right.
I'm sorry. I have to present something to you guys because it's tripping me out, and I'm looking at something here. And I was trying to remember in the judgment card if it's actually Michael that has the trumpet in the Rider-Waite deck, because you have there's a formula. It's a mathematical code in Kabbalah where if you take Tetragrammaton and you spell it out with haze, you get 39, and then well, there's this whole thing where if you add then the hay, right, or how does it work, you're basically, I have it written down in my notes, it's symbolic from the prophecy of how the dead will rise from their graves, and it's through the dew. And so the dew, the word for ma, right, which is the source of mana, right, when the thing, and it literally right, translates right. to what is it? It's a question. Mana is a question. And
right.
so there's this whole formula there. And I every time I look at that judgment card, that's what I feel like I'm looking at. And it's how to make it 45, which is the value of Adam, but it's also the value of, oh, fuck, what is it? Of Ma. Ma is 45. 4 and 5. Ma.
Right.
Mem Hey. And so, anyways, I'm going into this whole thing, and I'm tripping out of the fact that this fucking guy who directed The Visitor, his name is Michael Paradise, which he chose just for that movie to call himself, and this took place in Paradise, Nevada, the MGM Grand Hotel burning down. And so I'm like, is that fucking Michael in that card? And so I'm reading here in a tarot form, who knows where this person's coming from, but whatever. It says, the great archangel is not only protector of the Christians on earth, but of those in purgatory as well. He assists the dying, accompanies the souls to their private judgment, brings them to purgatory, and afterward presents them to God as their entrance into heaven. Thus, he is the actual patron of the holy souls. As Satan is ruler, quote-unquote, in hell, so Michael is the governor of heaven. And then they put in parentheses, it must be Latin, Propositus Paradisi. Paradisi.
Can you spell that for me?
P-R-A-E-P-O-S-I-T-U-S. But then the second part is P-A, so this must be how you say heaven in Latin, is P-A-R-A-D-I-S-I. And isn't
that Paradisi? Yeah, that's paradise. It's not heaven. It's different.
Right, but it's just interesting that it says that here in regards, because I was thinking about that as I'm looking this up, that he's Michael Paradise, and then in regards to Archangel Michael, they're saying this about heaven. So according to the ancient books, the church expresses its patronage in her liturgy in the offertory. I don't know prayer. Requiem masses, she prays Saint Michael, the banner bearer, may conduct them into the holy light. So he has a banner extending from his trumpet, right? If I recall.
Yes. But you have to. One of the things that's important is this ceremony that you're describing, and believe me, I am intimately knowledgeable of it.
Cool.
Is one given to a dead person?
Right.
It's funereal. Right, so the offertory is a funereal rite. So Michael is now becoming the carrier of the person's soul to paradise, but they have died essentially. So, and this creates to me a dichotomy in terms of the idea of life and death and what it means. Just like, and I'm just pointing that out because it's something that I find troubling. But in terms of what you're describing, it's dead on the money. You know, you mentioned the number 39, right, David?
Yes.
Well, okay. There were supposed to be three sync books, each with 26 to make a total of 78, so that there would be one sync book chapter and three books for each card in the deck of tarot, right? Mm-hmm. This is Alan Green's plan. I don't know, did you know that?
Yeah,
okay. Well, what I asked him to publish mine as the 39th installment.
Mm-hmm.
Moon in the Middle. Now, to me, here's the 3-9 and what it means. It's the number 9 of, so the repetitive number 9 of John Lennon, right? Number 9, number 9, number 9. There's a book called The Moonstone and also The 39 Steps, and both of those were written by the same author that are very revealing in terms of the meaning of the number 39. But
39 Lashes of Christ as well, right?
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, son of a gunshy. Isn't that interesting? I did not know that.
You remember that in Jesus Christ Superstar? He's counting? 38.
I don't know, because every time I watch Jesus Christ Superstar, I'm watching it with Marilyn Manson's Antichrist Superstar. So I've never actually seen it with sound.
Jesus Christ Superstar is one of my favorite films. I mean, I could pretty much watch it at the drop of a hat, but I haven't in some years. And I didn't know that. Well, you see, so if you take it as number nine, like 3-9, right? So what you're having is, we have Yesod, right? Which is the moon, and the moon is in the tree of life, is number 9, right? Yesod, meaning I believe foundation, and I think that makes sense because it's a foundation could also be called the cornerstone, and if my analogy that the tree of life is in fact a very simply a clock, in which Malkut swings from side to side, then Yesod would be the foundation, the moon. The fixed point, the thing in space that does not move, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this allows for the recalibration of the way you think, because we think about the moon as something that goes around our world. But when, for me, the meditation of the idea as the moon is something that does not move totally changed the way I thought about reality, completely changed it. So anyway, and it fits in with this idea 39, number 9 being repetitive or fixed, right? In terms of, and then Yesod being the moon, and 39 being represented in terms of the sink, as we understand it, by this book, The Moonstone and the 39 Steps. And of course, if you count up to 39, or if you're going by way of, if you created a pyramid for the tarot cards, it would have to go up to 39, and then there would be a flat point, like it's almost like a Mayan two-dimensional pyramid, where 39 and 40 would take positions at the top, and then it would scale back down to 78, right? Creating a point, but there would still be a flat top pyramid with 39 and 40 being at the top. So I had a point with all this. So what you have with 39 then is if it's the moon, then what you have is 13, 13, 13, which of course adds up to 39, right?
Mm.
So if number 9 is indeed Yesod, by saying number 9, you're also saying moon, moon, moon over and over. And we all know the association of 13 to the moon that is automatic for a variety of reasons.
So that's 3 years then, right?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. This is the thing. I'm remembering, I wish I had my notes in front of me, but I believe 39 is the value of tall in Hebrew, which means due. Part of an equation.
Unbelievable.
If I recall correctly. So if it's tet lamed, what does that equal?
And tall, the word tall would be 430, right?
Oh, okay.
Right?
I don't know. I'd have to think it out.
Yeah, it'll be tav and lamed, right?
Though I think this is tet and lamed.
Oh, tet and lamed. So that would be then, what would that be? 38, interestingly enough, right? Or 39. Motherfucker, holy shit.
That's what I'm saying.
Unbelievable. Holy fuck. So tall is 39. Yeah, of course.
And that's the thing that brings the dead back to life. When the dead rise up, that's what the equation implies.
Well, lamed being the prod, and then tall would be the fence. Tate is fence, right? Or is it snake?
Tet? Snake, yeah.
Yeah. So that gives you the spiral of the upward going caduceus and all that other stuff, and resurrection in the sun. And this is something, and again, going back to the Golden Dawn connection, this is something that is repeatedly stressed, is that we are resurrected in the sun.
This is interesting, too, because the sun destroys the dew. I was just reading this, and I think in a poem by Keats or something, but it's
very interesting. And of course, that's a natural function as well as we can see
how it's a symbolic.
And this is what I'm suggesting, right? Because we have we have the seven veils of Isis, which is a dance of deception, all right? And that's symbolized by Salome, who wants to basically separate you from yourself, as it's symbolized in the decapitation of John the Baptist. Separate your mind from your body. And this is what I believe that the scalable time sequence of the ritual hexagram is designed to do. To essentially separate your true mind, which actually exists in Deoth, from your body, which exists below. And I think, literally, now, at this moment, and I'm making this up as I go along, that the supernal three, like, literally rain into Deoth. It is a well. It is not an abyss. It is a well. That is what I think. And into this divinity drips, and only from there can it be drawn, which is why we have to attempt to cross it, only to find out that crossing it is not the goal, but instead to draw from it, to draw that thing which is forbidden in this world because it is broken by a cycle of seven. So you have the seven veils of Salome, you have Isis representing 7/4 and the cube, and then the cube being represented by bringing down Saturn into the position of Uranus. Right? So that's, and by the way, the difference between paradise and in Latin, the word in Latin for heaven is celi, and it's the exact same word we get ceiling from, our English word ceiling. It's even spelled the same way. It means the sky. It means the limit or the top. And what I'm saying is that the Saturnine cycle makes an implication of scalability when in fact, and this may even go into something that I've read about the Tao and the so-called, people who walk, the walkers or something. I can't remember exactly what it was. They may have even called them the men of renown, essentially, in something I was reading about Tao. Where have all the men of renown gone? Is a question that some Taoist asked at some point. So what I'm suggesting is that this men of renown is the mind is now open to the sky, and it is no longer a time-based thing. But the body still lives in the material world. That's what I'm suggesting. And that this is, that the buffer to this is the concept of scalable time, and then ritual, and then ultimately the so-called as-above-below principle that is symbolized in the ritual of the hexagram. Are you guys following me here?
Yeah.
I mean, this is just, I'm just feeling this right now. I've been thinking about this for years, and it's just kind of coming out right now. Because I always wonder, like, what does this mean?
Yeah, I'm just checking the I Ching right now, Mark, because like you're saying, how the abyss turns into the well, and both of those are hexagrams, right? There's a hexagram 29 is the abysmal, right? And then hexagram 48 is the well.
Very interesting.
I think if we should check into that, because it may be that one turns into the other, like, which is.
See, that's what I'm kind of thinking, is that, okay, and let me just put this in terms of the whole cycle of seven being a buffer, the veil of Isis, preventing whatever can make it across the abyss, or whatever can draw forth from the abyss something, to prevent is this seven repeating cycle. Now, here's my theory, basically. So we have red, right, which we identify as the first color, and red is the fastest color, right? This is this phenomenon that we call in physics red shift. Something that exceeds away at the speed of light from the side of a viewer watching it go away is red in color. All right, This is called redshift. And it's the most that the eye or any telescope can catch you of a light moving away from a source. And of course, it's slower than the actual speed of the pure white light, much slower, ultimately infinitely slower, the white light that we would associate with the upper three, the supernal houses, right, which is what we're trying to make contact with. So here's what I'm saying. So you have this now. What happens secondary to that? The next color in the cycle is orange, right? The second color, the seconds. And seconds, of course, being the smallest normal unit of time. So what it does now, we can never catch up to red, but we can catch up. And this is where I think the seduction of Saturnine methods. And when I criticize the Saturnine methods in this way, I'm not saying that they're evil. I'm saying that they're an appropriate buffer, right?
Right, right.
It's like, it's actually saying, okay, it's like the Wheel of Fortune, you know? You're going to have to get your head through this. And your time will continue to cycle until you do. So it's not necessarily a bad thing, but I'm seeing it as a buffer, the world of scalable time, as symbolized by the as above, so below principle that is undertaken in the ritual of the hexagram when Saturn is brought down to essentially block Uranus. Now, here's what I think happens when Uranus is blocked. First of all, we fall into a world of punishment.
Constipation.
Yeah, the cubicle world, right? It's the black iron prison, it's cubicle, and everything is a pun, right? So when we are being pun-ished, we are subject to these puns. So the first order of punnery in the world of in the satanic or the orange-colored world, which is the highest of the false worlds that a human being can ascend to, and which they do simply by being on time, right? And the pride and the ability in the social world that being on time is represented by. It's very, very important, right? So that's the farthest that a person could go in this, and the red is unreachable. It's like the fleeing Diana. The fawn that runs away no hunter can catch, right? That's what keeps us staying in orange, is the belief that we might be able to catch up to red, all right? But really what we want to do is get to white, and red is actually a buffer. It's not a passageway. That's what I'm saying. It's a buffer. Okay, we're just meant to chase after it forever, and we can never actually do it. We need to completely descale the concept of time. And the way that's done is by recognizing that we're living in the orange world, the time of scalable time. All right, the world of scalable time. And in that world, we live in a punitive world, a world of puns, punishment, etc., Saturn being the punisher. Now, I know that Saturn has to resurrect as a positive thing, but that's the very nature of a static cycle, is that resurrection point at the top when all things, the golden age, I mean, that wheel isn't going to spin itself back down again if there's no golden age at the top. It's a lot like a brass ring on a carousel, you know, and those brass rings, hardly anybody ever gets them. They're hard to reach, right? They just, you know, they are. Go ahead.
I'm wondering about the role of Jupiter in this, right? Because if Saturn is fallen, right, mm-hmm. he's fallen into the underworld, and then this is when time starts, right?
Yes.
But he's trapped in the underworld by Jupiter, right?
Yes.
So,
tell you what that is. You see, Jupiter represents the material, the limit of the material world.
Space, right?
Yes,
space.
Seventh position. This is why Jupiter says to us, this is why Kubrick says to us, Freudian slip there. Thank you for that one, David.
Sure.
But This is why Cooper says to us that Jupiter and then beyond Jupiter is the infinite, basically, or that which is ultimately outside of time, right? So, and that's not really the truth.
So I want to mention something here. I came across a book called The Rabbi's Tarot by a woman named Daphne Moore, who's analyzing a manuscript of one of Jung's closest followers that she came across. And in that manuscript, there's this idea of the Jupiter center in the body being the solar plexus. And that this is literally likened to the seat of the instincts, so that what becomes determinism in terms of action. So what is leading you? And this is what, like, immediately when I was reading this, I was thinking of Donnie Darko, because that's the predicting
that image.
What's going to, like, and that it's emerging from the solar plexus. And so I was like, is that, like, the deal with, like, the two suns and the sunset in 2010?
Like, well, is actually, that, like, we're over. Just to make things simple, I mean, if you want to go look at my article Suicide Switch, it's all in there. There's a guy who wears a T-shirt, and the T-shirt is a woman leaping out of his chest. Hmm. And this is Diana leaping forth from Jupiter as an idea, as a principle of something that is material, and therefore giving us the lunar matrix, the material world, right, that we live in. Because only, see, and this is the thing, the sun is not matrixical. It has to be tinkered with constantly. This is what the architect is talking about, because the architect is essentially a solarist, right? So he's saying, you know, there's always this equation, there's this thing of one that we can't quite balance, and it comes back to bother us, and then we have to reset things and try again. And there's always this balance of one. Well, that balance of one is the lunar aspect itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the solarist cannot put the moon ever above it, right? And this is the flaw of the solarist, is that the moon sometimes is bigger than the sun, that it is more meaningful, and that it has its own kind of light to it and all that other stuff, and its own meaning. So this is what, and of course, the moment that Trinity sees the real world for the first time and ever is when she sees the moon right before she dies, and she says, oh, it's beautiful, right? And that's when their ship goes up above the cloud cover created by the alien architecture. And then she comes, all they see is the moon gleaming in the sky. Okay, this is the hint that I'm trying to get at, is that there is a there is a solarist principle that blocks the mind from the sky. And that solarist principle is actually hides behind it a Saturnine principle. The sun, of course, is like the bliss moment. Hey, spread the sunshine, it's all good, right? We don't have to worry about time. But then, come Monday and Tuesday. Monday, of course, being the day we are supposed to start work, right? And that's in my article in Moon in the Middle. I talk about, like, just another manic Monday. I wish it was Sunday, right?
Right.
Sunday's
right.
The day in which you release yourself, in which you can become that person who dances in freedom. But Monday comes around, and it's time to pay the check again.
Goodbye, Blue Monday.
Yeah, and Monday is a grace period, actually. Tuesday's the day of real work. Tuesday being Mars, the color blue, blue collar, all that other stuff. So, and then finally, what happens with Jupiter is that it's the limit of the material world that can be sensed, essentially. And it's also the lightning path, right? And if you just write a lightning path down a page, and then you write another one, and you start crisscrossing this, you're going to see the word Isis popping up over and over and over again. And this is what the ultimate face of Isis is. She is an electrical field that the human body cannot cross. It can't. But the mind can. And this is what I mean about punishment. And I don't have too much longer to talk, guys. I feel like kind of a jerk about this, but I'd like to cap this off and maybe close out our conversation in a friendly way. But so here's the thing. So in the world of punishment that is under time, Saturn, the prison, the iron cubicle, right? We all know Saturn in the cube. So I'm not in the world of corners and rules and laws. We are separated from a non-scalable, non-empirical reality that is in fact represented by Uranus when the puns are removed. But in order to illustrate that, we have to look at the puns first. Uranus is obviously your asshole, which is exactly the opposite of purity in this world. It's exactly the opposite of what you want to cover yourself in, right? So that's the first pun. The person who discovered Uranus is called Herschel, as in Hershey or the old Hershey Highway, right? There's another pun inside our time-based scalable world. And to the right hand, in the position of the ritual of the hexagram, with Uranus representing Deoth, at its immediate right hand is Mars. And that's the other big chocolate company in the United States. Recharge on Mars and Hershey's and all that other stuff. So when we eat chocolate, of course, we are eating shit, sugared up shit. We become flies, essentially. And flies, of course, time is what flies. And so we're in the time piece. So do you see what I'm getting at? The way all these puns work. To potentially conceal another meaning to Uranus. Now, here's the thing. There are rings around Saturn, and they are what we might call perpendicular to the solar mechanism, right? This is the way they're always pictured, at least. And that's very important. When we imagine Saturn, we show the rings of Saturn at a slightly tilted degree to what would be 90 degrees to the sun. Right? Essentially, they're flat. They seem to be like a saucer that is wobbling just a bit, right? So you're following me on that, right? And yes. You see this in the way that the Saturnine hats are worn too, right? Wide brim hats, slightly tilted off to one side, all right? So, but Uranus also has rings around it. You should check. And both rings are actually at the exact opposite angle, right? So they form a gate. They are a gateway. So in a very real sense, and this is one of the amazing fucking things about David's recent mashup of Eyes Wide Shut, Full Metal Jacket, the movies playing at the same time, and The Shining. And then he's got the Floyd album, Wish You Were Here album. No, not is it Wish You Were Here? No, it's not.
It's Wish You Were Here.
Yeah, okay, yeah. He's got that album playing on there. It's fucking incredible. You can actually see that Kubrick sees the rings of Saturn as blades of a saw. They are a Sith. They are the path of a Sith that separates a human being into concomitant parts.
You know, Mark, it's really interesting that you'd say that, because the video that I did with, I was going down this whole kind of rabbit hole with Tony Scott, Ridley Scott's brother who committed suicide right after the premiere of the film The Grey that he was the executive producer of. And I ran an experiment playing the two simultaneously, The Grey and Alien, and it's uploaded right now, but they happen to be the exact same length to the second. The Grey and Alien, and Alien.
I started to watch it, but I'm like, oh, can I deal with this?
Alien actually ends with a 723 on the hibernation tank that Ripley is in, and so Ripley is Ridley with a flipped. You flip the P and you get a D, right? So it's him.
Yes.
But there's this whole deal where, like, the film The Grey is based on a book called The Ghost Walker. And while watching the film, I had the sense that I was watching a film where everyone was dead, and I didn't know that was the title of the book that it came out.
Yep. After I watched The Grey, I said to my mom, "These people all died in the plane crash."
Yes.
And each individual section, and there are seven of them, in the film, is a person coming to terms with death in their own particular way.
Sure.
Some as a confrontation, some as just giving up to nature. She was so pissed off because she hated the movie. And the film is so Catholic.
Right. So totally, totally. And
because there are seven stages of Catholic, and the last one of those is death.
Oh,
the
final really? I didn't sacrament, know that.
The final Catholic sacrament, and this is why you need a priest to give you last rites, even if only to your dead body, is to receive all the seven sacraments and actually go to heaven according to the Catholic tradition. The final one is death itself.
Huh. So you know that the wolves are essentially... they're demons or angels, depending on how you look at it, because they're liberating people from purgatory or something of the like. But anyways, I actually played Tool's Lateralis over this.
Yes.
And if you look at when Tool released Lateralis on vinyl, the cover of it is actually, and this shows up in the CD as well, I believe, where he has the blades of like the cutting blades that are rigid, you know, the rigid blades. And with as eyes, and there are a bunch of eyes in a fucking circle. And I was looking at that yesterday when I was updating my blog, and I was thinking about the Sith and relating it, and the fact that the first song on that album is, you know, The Grudge, which he's like, it's all about alchemy, where he's like, Saturn comes back around, lifts you up, I can't remember the lyrics exactly, but it's about the alchemical process and focusing on Saturn.
Yes, it says, well, I see, and I know it's there. And I mean, that's amazing because I didn't even think of that Sith kind of, or you call it Psi is what I call it. Some people call it.
I don't know. I'm probably pronouncing it
the pronunciation
wrong.
That we use up here is Psi. We just call it a Psi.
I know some Hebrew. I don't know anything else.
It's actually a Western pronunciation. Sith is Sith is kind of like people who didn't ever use one. We call it that.
Right. I never had to use one of those guys.
That's the way it reads, and it's academically it's still pronounced that way. But if you look it up, you'll see that the pronunciation Psi.
Okay.
And I live in a farm world where people actually used those things. And by the way, in the movie The Master, that whole thing with the Psi and he's cutting off the cabbage heads.
Right.
This is the motion of the moon too. As a lens that kind of takes a picture of something and then holds it in space. But anyway,
this is also the instrument that Saturn uses to castrate his father.
Of course. And it goes on and on and fucking on. And I mean, it gets really weird. But I guess what I'm wondering right now, and I'm wondering it to you guys, and I actually have to leave like in the next 30 seconds here. But what I'm wondering to you guys is it possible that this whole alchemical process, that the promise is simply the promise of a heroic cycle and that it is not developmental and that actually that a leap must be made? And actually Crowley suggests this too. He calls it the leap of laughter. He says you must leap into the abyss with a leap of laughter if you want to cross it. And I don't know exactly. I can't find the source. I'm sorry, guys. I know I read it somewhere.
I need to ask really quick to Zenora. Do you mind if this goes up possibly as an always record?
Yeah, I think that's fine.
Okay,
cool. Me too. It's fine with me too. If you're okay with it, Snor. Yeah.
Sweet. It'll probably be a while before it makes it up, but yeah, thank you.
Yeah, put it up there. Throw it up there. What the hell? But anyway, so this is kind of where I'm at there, is that this ritual of the hexagram, which indicates this reflexive or dualistic world, and then even a dualism breaks into pluralism, which leads back into monadism, and all of these things seem to cycle 1, 2, 3 over and over again, right? And what I'm suggesting is that maybe that there is some kind of a leap that must be taken where certain principles have to essentially be suspended, and those principles would be that of the hexagramic as above, so below things. Like maybe there aren't two sides to every story. Maybe there's only one side. Maybe the world is legitimately flat. So many things. I mean, there are ways to recalibrate reality in this sense. And that for me, since I wrote Moon in the Middle, which was very much a spontaneous work because it was forced upon me by slave driver Alan Green, essentially, who wanted this thing from me. And I didn't really want to do it. And he kept prodding me and I kept putting it off. And then finally, I went full on William Faulkner and, you know, a case of whiskey and 2 weeks later, this article was 1 week late. Actually, I sent him an email and he said, because he wanted the articles to be 3,000 words long.
Right.
I sent him an email saying, here it is, 3,090 words. I said, but some of them I use more than once. Because there's 3,090 different words in the article. So it turned out to be 9,000 words. But the thing of it is that as soon as I finished writing that, I sat down and all of a sudden I started seeing it very strongly everywhere. And that's why I'm presenting this theory to you guys now, because I think there is this kind of mechanism, this kind of, you know, kill yourself by becoming yourself sort of thing. That it's almost a killing the Buddha kind of thing. And it seems to be cross-cultural, and this is something that is actually encouraged in terms of mystical thought, that you need to submit to this. And I'm suggesting that maybe, you know, you need to stand up in class and say, yeah, I'm going to the men's room and I'm going to have a smoke or something like that. And let everybody else do the ritual. And then that's kind of, I'm wondering about that. So, you know, there you have it.
There you have it. Thank you.
Well, I love talking to you guys. This is really, I mean, I can't believe this. This is like today. I feel like I kind of won like a one-armed bandit, you know? Because I talked to my friend Alex earlier and I thought, okay, you know, that's out of the way. It's time for my nap now. You know, that was hours ago. I've had no nap.
Right.
It's 11 o'clock and I'm going to have to drink tonight just to be able to sleep. So
totally.
I need to run because the liquor store closes in 15 minutes. So.
Okay, cool, man. I'll see you. Okay.
Peace out. Yeah. I can't thank you both enough for this chat.
You got it, man.
Yeah, that was excellent. Right.
Much love to both of you. Bye-bye.
All right, too, man.
And now the embarrassing pause while I hang up. Right, catch you later, guys. Bye bye.
People you love will turn their backs on you. You'll lose your hair, your teeth. Your knife will fall out of its sheath. But you still don't like to leave before the end of the movie. People you hate will get their hooks into you. They'll pull you down, you'll frown. They'll tar you and drag you through town. But you still don't like to leave before the end of the movie. No, you still don't like to leave before the end of the show. Still don't like to leave before the end of the show.